Okay, so I'm going to talk about basically generation of a topological Hamiltonian. And the generation is in a stroboscopic fashion, and that has some advantages actually also for doing operations on a topological phase. So that's the main aim here of the work. And it's a work in progress. We aren't quite finished yet, so I'll tell you where we've got to, but it's looking pretty good. And so basically the main part of the work is done by two graduate students, Chris Herdman and Kevin Young, and then a lot of input from Vito Scarola and Mohan Sarovar, who are both postdocs. And we're closely coupled on this, very closely coupled to experiments of Dave Weiss at Penn State and Yang-San Kim, who's at Duke University. Okay, so first of all, I'll say a few words about topological phases, because probably, yeah, this is not the audience that would be bored by that. And then the rest of the body of the talk is divided into two parts. Firstly, how we actually generate the n-body terms in the Hamiltonian that are required typically for generating topological phases. And then secondly, what we realized in doing this is that when we make these simulations of n-body interactions, they're imperfect. Gates are imperfect. We're using a truncation of a Magnus expansion and so on. So that's going to introduce errors. And so we have local heating of the phase, and we've developed a local thermalization and cooling scheme to remove those errors. So that's the second part. Okay, so first of all, some words about topological phases. So topological phases are of great interest to a lot of people in other hallways here for protecting quantum information. So a topological phase is a two dimensions in space, one in time phase, which has a non-local quantum order. And it's an emergent order, so there's no apparent order parameter in the Hamiltonian. But then if you actually look at a large system, you'll see there's an emergent order, which is of a highly non-local nature. And in terms of understanding it, I think from a simple perspective, it's good to look at the three characteristics shared by topological phases. Firstly, that when one has degenerate and an infinite system massively degenerate ground states, and this is where one typically, for quantum information, would want to encode the qubits. Then there's a finite gap to the excited states, indicated here, and that's where the protection comes in. And then thirdly, these phases are characterized by having quasi-particle excitations with fractional statistics. So these are anionic excitations. So in order for quantum information, in order to use them for quantum information, one has to create and transport quasi-particles to make qubit operations. And we're not going to be concerned with that right now, but in the future that would be possible with the scheme we're developing. What I'm going to be concerned with today is the protection against generating a Hamiltonian that provides this protection, and then implementing this protection against local errors. So one very well-known realization of this is the toric code due to Kitaev, which is characterized by four-body interactions. Basically, on a 2D square lattice, one would have plaquette operators and vertex operators here, which would connect spins at adjacent sites. And the Hamiltonian is a sum of all possible vertex operators. So these are four X spins on sites here, tensored together, and then a sum also over all possible plaquette operators, which are tensored products of four Z operators. Okay, so that's a four-body Hamiltonian, and that's what we want to simulate. So that's the simplest possible topological phase.
The spins that you're talking about is the quasi-particle excitation.
No, the spins are the pseudo-spins which constitute the Hilbert space of the system, which generate the Hilbert space of the system. The excitations would be excitations in this Hilbert space, and that would generate this. So basically we have a set of spins on a lattice, and that spin under this, these spins under this Hamiltonian generates this spectrum.
So the spins are just like the internal states of the atoms?
They will exactly be hyperfine states of the atoms. Yeah, I'll come to that.
Those lambdas are equal?
Yeah, in the simplest version, yes. Yeah. Because on a square lattice, actually, the vertices and the plaquettes are dual to each other. So then the simplest version has them equal. You could make them unequal too, but I'm going to just have them equal. Okay, so the goal of this is a DARPA project, so have a goal. And the goal is actually that Dave Weiss would actually demonstrate all the components of topological quantum computing in an optical lattice experimentally, okay, using the schemes that we're developing theoretically. So the long-term goal is to actually create these quasi-particles and transport them, show that we can transport them around sites on the lattice in a optical lattice with a small number of sites, okay, because we're only demonstrating the components. We're not going to generate a true thermodynamic phase. And the first part is to actually implement the Hamiltonian, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. And so we're going to see how we can implement this using Rydberg interactions between neutral atoms in optical lattices, and together with one qubit gates. Okay? And I'll say a few words about the experiments just to put the theory in context. So that's actually one of the slides here for the experiment. This is Dave Weiss's 3D optical lattice apparatus. So he has a blue detuned optical lattice, which is formed by these six sets of laser beams. And it traps the atoms tightly in essentially a three-dimensional cubic lattice. And he can get typically about half filling quite easily. And then we developed earlier an algorithm to take a random filling and to compact it into a perfectly filled smaller volume. Okay. So we know how to do that with basically a combination of single qubit operations and shifting polarization of the light fields. Okay. So we can assume for our purposes today that we will have a subset of these sites which is perfectly filled, one atom per site. Okay. And the unique aspect of Dave's experiments are that his lattice is a large wavelength lattice. I'm not sure I put that. It's about 5 micrometers spacing between the sites, and that means it's individually addressable. So he's actually already managed to image single atoms in this array, and that's these images shown here are images of different planes, two-dimensional planes, going back along the z-axis of sets of about 35, 40 atoms. Okay, so that demonstrates the single site addressability. So what he will use is single qubit rotations, which will either be microwave addressing, or Raman gates, which are preferred because they're faster. And he'll use Rydberg interactions between excited states to generate entanglement. Okay, so I'm going to take all that as a given now, and then tell you how we will generate this topological phase, or firstly the Kataev Hamiltonian, using these interactions. Okay, so our starting point is Magnus expansion, which I've written here in the propagator form. So basically, we imagine having a series of unitary operations, and I'm using the propagator form because we're basically taking a gate model. So we're going to use single qubit gates and two qubit gates. So for our purposes, these will actually be gates, but these are just exponentiated Hamiltonians. Okay. So that's the full Hamiltonian, and then this is expanded in terms of commutators, time-ordered propagators, and so on. And so we have this expansion. So the claim is that these gate sequences can dynamically approximate the action of a static n-body Hamiltonian. And I'll show you that that's actually true for this example. And then in doing this, we realize that the lattice system will not remain in a thermal state, however, of this effective Hamiltonian, because of essentially truncation errors. apart from all other kind of environmental errors that you may have. So the way we viewed this is to think, well, the noise in the applied case will add entropy and effectively heat the system. And you can estimate for actually random errors on the gate what the associated entropy increase from that is, and it goes linearly with the entropy per gate. So then we have to do some, either some error correction, standard quantum error correction, or what we prefer to do is cooling. And in fact, we have a, it turns out that we can do not just cooling, but we can actually do thermalization. So in fact, we could actually drive the system to a particular desired temperature. And that's of interest for these topological phases for some other reasons that I'll explain later.
So just to put things in perspective, is the philosophy similar to the very early work on simulations that the NMR guys did to generate like three-body Hamiltonians in like weakly coupled? Because you have only two bodies there,
right.
They use the average Hamiltonian to synthesize,
yeah.
And in fact it's three bodies.
I think it must be similar to that.
But
we looked at the, at least I looked a little bit around, I didn't see anyone going beyond three-body.
That's right.
Yeah, but I think it's similar because we're using, so you'll see the average Hamiltonian slide in a moment.
So basically just in terms of where you're going, you want to create the four body Hamiltonian.
Right. Troposcopically.
Essentially by making an effective Hamiltonian.
Right. And then we want to make this effective Hamiltonian out of the available interactions that we have in this optical lattice, which are 1-qubit gates and 2-qubit gates.
And the fact that it's the effective Hamiltonian that involves multiple interactions to create it, that's where we start.
Yeah. So at the end, I'll have a count of time, and I'll tell you how long one stroboscopic cycle takes for this system, and compare that to the decoherence time, to the intrinsic decoherence time of the atoms. And okay, so maybe for those who just came in, this actually is a summary of the talk. So maybe I'll just repeat it for you guys. So we're basically doing the Kitaev Hamiltonian, we're generating the Kitaev Hamiltonian stroboscopically. We're starting from a Magnus expansion approach. So we're going to generate effective propagators that will approximate the four-body Hamiltonian. Then we recognize that the lattice system doesn't remain in a thermal state while you're doing this because of gate errors, and in addition because of possible environmental errors. So realizing that, that we have some entropy, then production rate, we need to get rid of that. So we developed a cooling scheme. In fact, it's a thermalization scheme that I'll show you in the second part of the talk. Okay?
The rest of us needed a little more time to get to this.
Well, I had some slides on Kitaev model, so.
I have another question. So do you want to selectively get the fourth order of the four body only? And
yeah, we only want the four body.
Yes, because otherwise we'd have a relative loss of
strength
in front of it.
Because
it's going to be very weak.
Will be weak, but I'll talk about the effect of the additional terms. You get two-body terms at the truncation order that we have, that we deal with. Mm-hmm. And then, in addition, one has the error terms. Okay, so this, again, is just a summary of the toric code, and this actually is fairly important to explain. So the finite-size system that we're looking at least in the purpose of this talk, and I think that we'll actually be doing also in the experiment, is basically a system that has it's a 3x3 planar system, finite lattice, and, okay, so let me just explain the Hamiltonian again. So the spin degrees of freedom sit on the links of a square lattice in the Kitaev model, and there are periodic boundary conditions in both directions, so that's basically toroidal boundary conditions. So let me explain the geometry, how we map that into this 3D lattice. So just the red circles here are the atoms. Forget about the other things right now. Okay, so with the toroidal boundary conditions, we basically have these 18 spins here, 18 pseudo-spins, which constitute three periodic paths around a torus. And that is mapped into, it's a non-unique mapping. And here's one possible way in which one can do this. One can put this into a cubic system of 3 by 2 here and implement, so then these cycles around here are in these connections here around the torus are easily implemented by nearest neighbor couplings along here. So the green atoms here are the spins, okay, whereas here the spins were sitting on the links of the lattice. Here we have a 3D cubic lattice, that's a physical lattice, and here the spins will be at the sites. Okay. And then the links which implement the boundary conditions are these ones which wind around the torus. So these, some of these have to be implemented by connecting opposite sides of this finite set of atoms. And so one can do that by having basically a series of swap operations which goes around like this. So if one has, so we have the capability Dave has the capability to do about 250 atoms. So that's easily enough to have a central area of 18 and then a lot of other ones around which help you deal with the boundary conditions. And also we'll need extra pseudospins for the cooling. So that's the geometry. Then in terms of the Hamiltonian, I said before that the Hamiltonian consists of these two sets of terms. One are four-body vertex terms, which are indicated here. So this vertex term here would couple these four spins together with the tensor product of spin flips. And these other term is the Plaquet operators, which couple four spins here around a square.
I missed one thing. You said that up here you have the atoms that are in between lattice sites.
Yes, in 2D.
In 2D.
Yeah.
And here you have...
The atoms are now at the sites in the three-dimensional physical lattice.
But there's a one-to-one mapping.
There's a one-to-one mapping, yeah. And that mapping goes through recognition of the toroidal boundary conditions and figuring out who's connected to who here. Okay. And it's not, there's various, I can show you, at the end I'll show you some other different ways that might be easier for Dave to, I mean, for the experimentalists, we haven't optimized the swap, the path of the swaps, for instance. You might want to do. Well, that's all right. Let's make it exciting. All right, so then, okay, so we're up to here. So the ground state of this Hamiltonian has topological order, and on a torus, there's a fourfold ground state degeneracy. And also, fortunately for us, on a finite system, as long as we implement the boundary conditions correctly, we retain that fourfold degeneracy. Okay, so that's good. So that means that we can take the finite system and actually study some features with finite size scaling, study the features of the infinite system. So, and then as I mentioned before, there's an energy gap to the quasiparticle excitations. Now, and then the other things on this diagram on the right show you what these excitations are. So the excitations arise when you flip a spin. So supposing you flip a single spin here, then if you look at the Plaquet operator around this square here. So the ground state is given by all of the eigenvalues of all the Plaquet operators and all the vertex operators being plus one. Anytime you flip a spin, you get one of these Plaquet operators would have an eigenvalue minus one. So when you flip one spin here, supposing you had all spins same sign around here in the Plaquet, you flip the one spin here, you change the sign of the, you project yourself into the minus spin eigenspace of B, of the Plaquet operator, and you also do that with this one here, with this Plaquet here. So you've created two excitations, two Plaquet excitations. And these are referred to as magnetic excitations, magnetic vortices in analogy with get the fractional column Hall. So those are the excitations that live on the plaquettes, and they're connected by this string that goes through the links where the spins sit. And then the second kind of excitations are where, if we look at a vertex operator, so if we flipped this spin here, then this vertex operator around here will also change sign. So then we've created an excitation here. Now, actually, I should have looked at this one. If we flip this one, then this vertex operator changes sign, and also this vertex operator changes sign. So we've created a pair of excitations here as well. And these excitations are excitations in the A operator, And they're referred to as the charge excitations.
What's the difference between the M's and the E's? Because the E is on a boundary.
It's just that you're changing the sign of a different portion of the Hamiltonian. Okay. For now, I mean, that's all we need to know for now.
But the mechanism of doing it occurs
by flipping a single spin.
In both cases.
Yes.
But what
so you can create both. Flipping one spin, you may create both a charge pair and a magnetic pair.
With the same.
Depending what state the lattice is in.
But is there significance here, the fact that one of the E's that you have there is on the boundary?
No, not at all. Oh, no. This is just.
So there's no way we could tell this visually. There's no way we could tell visually that you get E's there and M's there.
No. I actually truncated this as a somewhat larger picture. Because this is a system we want to actually consider, and so this indicates there's periodic boundary conditions here. This guy is connected to this one. This is the smallest system where you can have periodic boundary conditions without having interference between self interactions.
And for atoms in the optical atoms, you don't need
the periodic boundary condition?
No, the flip of speed.
Oh, it's a pi gate. Yes, it's a 1-qubit rotation. I'll say more about that at the end.
One case you're flipping X, one case you're flipping Z.
Right. So it's a phase gate or a pi gate. Single spin. I'm not going to talk in detail about which levels, but I have some pictures at the end from the experiments which I think show you how you could do the one-qubit gates. But that's sort of a standard technology right now. Okay, so here's how we generate the four-body interaction. So we claim that we can get arbitrary two-body interactions that's perfectly acceptable, that we can get arbitrary two-body interactions from a combination of single pseudospin rotations. So the pseudospins are the atoms, they're cesium-133, they're hyperfine levels, two hyperfine levels of the cesium atom. So this, for example, this actually is a fairly lengthy sequence to generate EIYX. So if we have these cross terms, two Pauli spin operators, XYYYZ and XZ, so any of these could be generated by a sequence like this. This isn't really very efficient, but if you use these the geometric approach, you can show that you can use at most, you need one C phase gate, and then you have a number of single qubit operations, depending on whether you can do arbitrary single qubit rotations or you have to use qubit rotations along specific axes. So in this particular example, we used qubit rotations along specific axes, and there's six single qubit rotations. But if you can do arbitrary single qubit rotations, then you could have just four. Okay, so that's just one example. So these two-body interactions are what we're going to use as building blocks for the n-body interactions. So they're all going to be things, these three Hamiltonians here. Okay? And the pseudospins, I did it down here, defined in, that's another important point, they're defined in the rotating frame of the. So we're not going to have an intrinsic energy difference between the qubit levels, which is working in the rotating frame. But it's a constant rotating frame, it's not like a toggling frame that Lorenzo had. It's a frame which is defined at the beginning to give us our qubits have to be to generate an energy. Okay.
Where does the stroboscopic come in?
Ah. Yes. Okay. So we start with this, and then we have a pulse sequence. So, for instance, here's in three terms. If we have a pulse sequence which consists of this sequence, which this is an abbreviation for. The application of H3 for time tau, minus H3 for time tau, application of H1 for time tau, application of H2 for time tau. Okay? So this is a sequence of pulses of application of H1, H2, H3, each for time tau. So the total time here is 10 tau. And then if we put this into the Magnus expansion and basically do a lot of algebra, we find that we generate with this a fourth order term here, And so we keep, if you keep track of the indices here, alpha, beta, gamma, you see that you have here alpha, or three, you have to use all three of these Hamiltonians to get this fourth order term. Then you have a bunch of third order terms and a whole bunch of second order terms. Okay. And this is in order of the expansion. So the higher order expansion, we regain and again another fourth order term, and then it goes on. So this is the Magnus expansion with truncation of fourth order terms in time. Okay. So this is where the stroboscopic is going to come in, because this will generate the effect of Hamiltonian only at the time 10 tau. So it's already stroboscopic now. In between here, you can't ask what the states are doing, you can't ask what the Hamiltonian is. So we're guaranteed by the Magnus expansion that at time 10 tau will have this effect of Hamiltonian.
Why is that stroboscopic?
Because we're only going to generate the Hamiltonian at these specific time intervals. So you can only, if you want to look at what the system's doing in terms of topological protection, you can only look at those particular times. If you look in between, the state, they're doing something different. Right. Okay. So it's this usual idea of coherent averaging, that you really can only look and ask something about the system at the times where everything comes together again. Or it's like refocusing, right? You only look at the end. Don't look in between. Okay, so then as I think, so as Viola pointed out the other day, so if you just repeat the sequence with the opposite sign, then you can get rid of the odd terms. So then if we repeat the sequence and get now a 20 pulse sequence, we have something which has no third order terms. We have fourth order terms and second order terms if retained when we truncate with error tau 5. Okay. And this is what we're going to be using. So we're going to be dealing with something which has the fourth order term that we want. And in addition, we have these second order terms. So I'll tell you how we deal with that.
That is the time symmetrization.
Yes.
So what's the advantage of doing this versus sort of the sequence where you do this fan in and do a phase and then fan out, you know, get these many body Hamiltonians? You're only using local interactions?
Yeah.
There's neighbor interactions?
But you are two there, aren't you?
That would also be, yeah.
Yeah. I think I have a suspicion it's probably equivalent, but we can talk about it afterwards. Okay, so now this is the Hamiltonian that we generated. So we had the fourth order terms that we wanted. So what I showed you, you can do for both the vertex operations and for the plaquette operations. Okay, so you have the toric code Hamiltonian. You have, in addition, these second order terms. And it's convenient to also add an external magnetic field. This is for purposes of studying, analyzing the states that you have, because the field breaks all the ground state degeneracies. So these are calculations on the right, which are for this 3x3 lattice with 18 spins with the periodic boundary conditions. So these are exact diagonalization calculations of the toric code and showing how the energies, and also this is ground state fidelity here, but first of all, just the energies, how they vary as we change this perturbation here. And also, if I had... we get similar plots here if we increase the magnetic field. Okay, in other words, the magnetic field here will break these ground state degeneracies, just like these perturbations also break at large values of chi or large values of h. Now, in a finite size system, you want to break the degeneracy because you know that you're going to have finite size scaling, and so you want to be able to study that systematically. So it's good to know which states are which before you start to do finite size scaling. So this is just sort of an internal methodological thing that we want to have capability to do. And this so is easy to do by adding basically additional single qubit gates in this stroboscopic series. We just intersperse some Z gates, Z rotations. Okay, so don't worry about that. So now, Okay, so the point of these calculations is to really show you the effect of this perturbation, which is an essential perturbation. Okay, that we can't get rid of this.
So you could not intersperse additional rotation that causes it, for
instance,
in other universe? Because this can be removed by the collective. That's probably why you have to think about whether you can remove the collective process.
It's,
like
yeah.
In principle, yes, but I don't know what compatibility constraint yeah. will have with the rest. But
I don't know. Let's talk about that afterwards.
About removing yeah. your term, right? It's the same things.
Yes. Yeah, so it's possible. We haven't looked at that, but that would be interesting to consider.
Yeah.
There is a whole issue of compatibility of these stroboscopic series.
So,
yeah. That's part we haven't really figured out or completed yet. So, all right, so for now, let's assume that we can't get rid of them. So if we look here at these calculations, we see that the ground state overlap with the true ground state overlap with the state with a finite perturbation chi and also finite field is actually pretty good up until about perturbation strength 0.2. And this actually is interesting, it's useful because it means that we can tolerate a certain amount of perturbation if we want to study the features. So in other words, here, for instance, the gap, so this is the first four energies. So here's the ground, so in this region here, the lowest three energies, actually the lowest four, one of these is twofold degenerate, still even out here. The lowest set of energies are pretty much degenerate. And we have a big gap. So we can tolerate, to study the topological protection, we can tolerate this perturbation up to about here, possibly. We're going to actually just go up to here because the fidelity of the wave function gets worse.
I'm not sure if the fidelity is that important. I mean, assume that you have the degeneracy. This is an important thing.
Yeah, well, so then we're even better off. Then we're better off. We go to 0.4. Right. Right.
The state might change, but it changes so that it protects your system.
Right, right, right. So just to demonstrate the protection, it's fine to go out to here. Right. But if we want to characterize the states and to show that we stay in particular topological sectors, then this might be more restrictive condition might be necessary. Because we want to actually operate with braid operators on these states and figure out, you know, with a particular state, which sector we're in. And to show that the sectors are preserved. So.
I'm a little lost though about this. I'm missing exactly what the perturbations are. Because what you had previously was you had Hamilton, which is at the lattice sites.
Yeah.
And you had these plaquette.
So this, for instance, is a plaquette operator here in blue, and this is a vertex operator, the star connecting four spins. And now, in addition to the plaquette operator and the vertex operator, we have now these two-body interactions across the diagonals.
So these are unwanted.
These are unwanted. They're unwanted for the toric code Hamiltonian. And so these unwanted interactions act like an external field, and they give us then this. So they give us this splitting here at large values of chi. They give us splitting of the ground state degeneracy. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Principally, you could potentially even exploit those operators, though, but you could to make some effective Hamiltonian that we have.
Well, actually, these are the operators we're using to generate this effective Hamiltonian.
Oh, they are the
operators. Yeah, because remember I had H1, H2, H3, that was e to the I, and they were precisely this kind of operator.
Yeah, I only remember the plug here.
Yeah, no, these were the operators in the popular up here. So these are coming from a C-phase gate. These come from these are generated by controlled Rydberg interactions.
Okay. And so what's the difference between the ones that you want and the ones that you don't want?
Well, so if you look at the Magnus expansion, the ones that we want are the pure four-body terms.
But we
necessarily get a bunch of two-body terms.
I understand, but in terms of the bare Hamiltonian, the terms, the perturbations, are things that are surviving in the Magnus. I see the things that are surviving.
This is just rewriting the Magnus expansion, and I'm just pulling out this.
Surviving that you don't want.
Yeah, yeah. So this is the toric code Hamiltonian with some other coefficients in front of it that depend on alpha, beta, gamma.
So it's perturbation kind of, yeah. We usually think about perturbation theory.
Right.
These are the residuals of the magnets.
We call them truncation perturbations.
Yeah, okay.
To indicate that, I mean, it's sort of an inverse truncation, actually, because you're dropping off higher order terms. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right, so now to maximize the, so we've already talked about robustness. So I showed you with those diagonalization calculations that the code, the ground states are fairly robust with respect to the perturbations we generate by this magnetic expansion. And to maximize this robustness, we have to maximize, this is the coefficient of the plaquette and vertex operators, lambda, and that's now rewritten in terms of these coefficients which derive from the alpha, beta, gamma, from the two-body interactions. So everything's parameterized to the toric code effective field strength. The effective strength of the toric Hamiltonian is parameterized in terms of two-body interactions now. Okay? And the chi is of order phi cubed. So the maximal tolerable ratio is about 0.2. And if you put numbers into that, then you find for this system that the strength of the Hamiltonian that you can generate is about 1 millikelvin divided by number of atoms. And this is a this assumes that everything is generated in serial, which is the first thing that the experimentalists would do, but it's not it's definitely not what we want them to do. if we put them in everything, if you did everything in parallel, this would be one, which would be the ideal thing for a toric code Hamiltonian, because all the plaquettes and all the vertices are all present at the same time. So if you could generate all of those at the same time, then you'd have lambda 1 millikelvin. If you do some things in parallel, and it seems that the single qubit gates, certainly with Raman gates, can be done to some extent in parallel, then this gets smaller, okay, and that makes this larger. But this is, so it's certainly a disadvantage of a serial mode operation, that the effective strength, and so therefore the gap that you're looking at will get smaller with the number of atoms. So that's another reason for studying small finite size systems.
I was wondering with the wraparounds.
Yeah.
Those the torus.
Yeah.
Do you think it's possible to do entanglement swapping to make a semi parallel? So you could create entangled pairs in the ends and then do non-local gates.
Between the ends?
Yeah.
If you've only got the Rydberg gate, I'm not sure you can do that. Or maybe you can, actually, because the Rydberg... So he's doing the Rydberg in a selective, site-selective manner.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. We'd have to look at the numbers to see whether the range is large enough to go, you know, over that distance.
Or you could do things pairwise and then do measurements.
You can't do... This configuration, they can't do single measurements. They have to image, so I showed that at the beginning, they image the entire lattice or nothing at all. So you can't do, yeah, if they could do single measurements, then we could do a lot of other things. But they can't do that. But maybe a non-local C-phase gate might work. All right, so, yeah, so we're pushing for basically a parallel implementation. Okay, so here's some numbers about gate count and timing. So if we take one of those components of the Magnus expansion, that takes a time, I specified time, tau, right? So the H effective that we're using takes time 20 tau. And if we have 18 spins and we're doing it in serial, so then we have 360 tau to implement the full Hamiltonian. And the minimum tau that we can have would be, as I said before, one C phase and 4 1-qubit gates. So and the corresponding times for these are basically of the order of 100 nanoseconds, both of them coincidentally. That's if we use the Raman gates. So if we put that all together, the minimum time in serial mode to generate this entire Hamiltonian is about 180 microseconds. And that's compared, so that's the time for one stroboscopic cycle of the full Hamiltonian. And that's, so that's actually relatively short compared to the decoherence time of the atoms in the optical lattice. So it's encouraging. So that's, you know, so here you see the big advantage of the atoms, neutral atoms trapped in optical lattices. They have very, very long intrinsic decoherence times. So even though 100 microseconds is pretty long in terms of other systems, but so provided you can do these pulses in a robust fashion, one after the other, bang, 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 then you could generate this.
Is this DSWS?
Dave Weiss. That's, we're collaborating with Dave Weiss. So these are his current estimates for the time.
And the parallel would be significantly faster.
The parallel would be significantly faster, yeah. So, okay, since I've come here, so I talked a bit with Cristiano and Tommaso, and I think there are opportunities for optimal quantum control here that would to improve this further as well. In particular, well, both of the, all these two components. If one can really optimize these, then one could possibly also, you know, reduce these by maybe up to an order of magnitude. So that's a good option for the future.
About temperature, do you have any idea now if all these gates increase temperature? Or?
Yes. You're welcome. So we thought, actually originally we thought we're done, we'll send it to Dave Weiss and he'll do the experiment. But then we realized, yes. Yeah, so you generate a lot of errors. So as I indicated at the beginning, so we then thought about how to decrease the errors. So we first of all were thinking about doing a cooling scheme. And then we realized that we could do something more general, which is that we can actually thermalize the system. So we could drive it to a specific desired finite temperature as well as zero temperature. And that's what I'm going to show you here. So the way we do that is we first of all rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of local excitations. And this is not very intuitive, unless you've done it, but Chris worked this out. So this is a toric hood Hamiltonian rewritten in terms of the gap and these excitation operators. Now these excitation operators are, they're shown here. So there's two types of them. There's M and E types of excitation operators correspond to the excitation I showed you before. And this is delta is the gap to create a pair of excitations. So, and I is other links. Okay, so if we look at one of the operator E, this creates an excitation pair in the neighborhood of link I. So if this is link I, so as I said before, you change the eigenvalues of these two quartet operators when you flip their spin, and so you generate a pair of magnetic excitations. Yeah. Okay, so that's the operator E. Then the other operator that comes out, and there's a corresponding E dagger for the charge operators. E. Okay. The other operator that you get is a translation of an excitation operator. And that is illustrated here. So this is a T operator. What this does is if we flip, so we have a pair of excitations here. If we now flip this spin, then we'll change the sign back on this plaquette. So the excitation no longer lives here, but we've disrupted the sign, flipped the sign on this plaquette, so the excitation has moved over to here. So this operator translates the excitation. So these are quasi-particle translation operators, and this is a creation. So the idea then is that we take these local operators and we couple them to dissipative systems. So we're now going to add additional pseudo-spins that are identical to the original ones. Yes?
It's not a toric hood Hamiltonian.
It's an additional Hamiltonian. No, it's a toric hood Hamiltonian. Yeah. I didn't believe this at first either, but it is. Yeah. So I'll show you what these things look like in a moment. Okay, so then we're going to couple these to additional pseudo-spins, and then we're going to drive those additional pseudo-spins to cool the system or to thermalize it. Okay? So this is probably the most transparent way to view these operators. So, okay, let's look over here. Okay, this is actually a seven-body term. So it sounds counterintuitive. You have a four-body Hamiltonian. You've now written it as a sum of seven-body terms. But when you add it all together again, there's a lot of cancellations, and it is indeed a four-body Hamiltonian. Okay. But these, what these terms look like are basically these are the errors on the plaquettes, and this is the guy in the middle. Okay, so you see there's seven spins actually connected here. Okay, and the same with these. Okay, so how are we going to stabilize the thermal state of these excitations? So we set up a master equation, use Lindblad form, and with this specific choice of Lindblad operators that probably some of you recognize well, so you have a population of the excited states and relative population and a rate of thermalization rate, then you will get you're guaranteed to get a stationary thermal state. Okay, so we want to now set up an array of pseudospins surrounding the system that are coupled to the system that will generate this Lindblad form. Okay? More engineering. You look puzzled.
Yeah. Let's go back a second. My natural.
Before?
Anyway. No.
Here.
So you're. Master equation only looks at populations. There's no coherences.
No, there's coherences. Okay. We have the entire density matrix.
Yeah. But somehow your Lindblad operators.
Our Lindblad operators contain creation and annihilation operators for the excitation, and also translation operators. Okay, so
the Lindblad operator is engineered.
I'll show you how it's going to come. Okay, so how do we generate this form?
I understand why you want cooling, but I don't really, unless you understand why you want thermalization.
I'll come at the end. Yeah. If there were some people from across the hall here, they would understand. There's issues about whether topological phases persist at finite temperature. Basically. So all the theory about topological phases up till a couple of years ago was done at zero temperature. And then, actually, Nusinov and Ortiz, Zohar's here, they pointed out that in an infinite system, in the thermodynamic limit, there's a zero temperature phase transition. So the topological phase basically doesn't exist above a finite temperature. And then there was more work, though, that showed that in a finite system, that you do have a finite temperature range over which the topological phase exists.
Yeah, but still, what does thermalization help
you? No, it would be interesting to examine in a finite system what's the temperature regime over which it's stable.
No, but how does it help you get rid of the errors?
What we want to do is we will generate the state of the system at a particular temperature. So it would be the natural finite temperature state of the system.
The statement is that for a certain size of a system and for a certain temperature, you can see if you have topological order, you can use it still.
Yes. If you still have the effective gap and you have to redefine it.
Isn't necessarily for at this point to remove the errors.
No. Well, you want to drive it to a specific temperature, and you don't want unwanted errors that would drive it to a much higher temperature. Okay. So in a sense,
two different types of errors. Errors in the logical space, and if you have the Hamiltonian overprotecting, and then you have thermal errors on the top.
Yes.
The thermal errors are much harder, so you have to have low enough temperature so the system actually operates properly.
So everything we're doing here protects us against errors in the logical space.
Yes.
We're protected against thermal errors in the logical space. The thing we're not protected against is leaving the Hilbert space of the pseudospins. And that's, again, where another place where optimal control might help us. All right, everyone's up to speed now?
But if I combine what you said with what John just said, you want to thermalize to as low a temperature as possible.
Yeah, well, we really want to go to zero temperature. That's clearly what anybody wants to do. But then it turned out when we were developing this, we realized that we could actually go to a finite temperature as well. So why not? And it would be of interest in a finite system to raise the temperature a little bit and just to see how fast you lose the topological order. Yeah.
It's a theoretical
interest.
You don't want to have it, but...
Well, it's also of interest to the fractional quantum Hall people, right? I mean, they can't work at zero temperature.
Yes, sir.
right? So all the experiments, you know.
So there's a statement that the fraction called Hall effect, the non-abelian character disappears at zero temperature if you have three vortices. You would like to have a bit of temperature there in order to restore the non-abelian character.
Oh, really? Well, then that's another factor yet again, right? Yeah.
Don't think it is for the systems you hope, but definitely.
All right. So if you want, just forget about the thermalization here. Just think, I'm going to thermalize to zero temperature. That's the goal. That's the first goal one would want to do. So what we do is we add two sets of pseudospins, sigmas and taus, and they're coupled to the system. I'll show you what the geometry is in a moment. One of these sets of pseudospins is designed to undergo dissipation to a thermal state. Okay, and these pseudospins, so there's just two levels here. The second set, and this set is actually only needed for the finite temperature thermalization. At zero temperature, you don't need this. This is a pseudospin which undergoes dissipation to a fully mixed state. And that's really needed at finite temperature because you have to have both excitations and, well, you need basically the you need everything. Whereas at finite temperature, you just need creation operators. Okay, so each.
Fully mixed state is essentially
infinite temperatures. Yeah. I didn't want to write infinite temperature because I thought that would add more confusion. Right. Each dissipative pseudospin is coupled to a local neighborhood. Okay, so how does that work? It works like this. So this is a system today. So here is a row now. Oh, sorry. Let's see. Well, I think there was a font problem here. This is probably the. Yeah, this is a system qubit, the red ones, and this is sigma. This is the pseudospin. The pseudospin guy here. So the pseudospin guy is connected to three of these. So we construct them. We have to construct an effective system reservoir interaction. Okay, and that effective interaction that we construct is this. And this, if you just remember what I said before, that the E's and the T's are seven-body terms, this is clearly an eight-body interaction. Okay, this interaction will be generated stroboscopically, just like the four-body interactions. Okay, now this is what you need for thermalization. For zero temperature, it turns out, so in a moment, you only need four body. So you're back to where we were. No. So if you really want to go to finite temperature, there's a lot more work involved. Because you'd have to generate these eight body terms stroboscopically. Okay, so if you put this in, and now you have the Lindblad, you combine this with the Lindblad generators for these pseudospins, and then I'll show you in another few minutes the physics of how we would generate these terms, okay, in the neutral atoms. If you put these things, first of all together and solve the master equation, you find in the weak coupling limit, so where this interaction between the dissipative pseudospins and the system spins is small compared to the Hamiltonian parameter lambda. I think it's small compared to the Hamiltonian lambda. Great. Well, it might be. Well, the problem here, we have two lambdas. That's what I discovered last on the weekend in preparing these slides. So there's this lambda is also, I think it's the rate of dissipation of the pseudospins. All right, so it's weak coupling that the interaction strength is smaller than the rate, so it's fast. It's fast relaxation of the pseudospins. Then we get an effective master equation for the system, which has the desired form that we wanted with the lambda stars. Remember, that's the way I wrote it originally. Okay, and so now we have an explicit expression for the scaled thermalization rate lambda star in terms of the interaction between the pseudospins and the environment and the system, and also the intrinsic thermalization of the pseudospins, the dissipated pseudospins. Okay, and then with this, the thermal state of this is a stationary state. So now we have all the ingredients, and we have to see, can we implement this and these Lindblad terms with neutral atoms, with the same neutral atoms? First of all, so I want to show you, first of all, that that was general for finite temperature. If we just want to go to the ground state, we're much better off. So what I showed you now is you got an n-body Hamiltonian, you'd get two n-body interactions to thermalize. But if we want to just go to the ground state, we can achieve this with just n plus one body interactions. And so we have these operators here, which are the sums of the E's and the T's. And we just need this system reservoir interaction. Essentially, because we don't need all these translation operators of the excitations. So, and if you look here, these are the ground state cooling operators, these C's. When you add the E's and the T's together, you get a lot of cancellations, and you see that you then just get you regain a full body interaction. So that's basically a Plaquette operator with another XI that belongs to, so this is a vertex operator, and then it's tensored with an XI which is inside the vertex operator, so it's still only a full body operator. Okay? Okay, so that's good. And let's see. And then we have, for cooling, then we have just one set of pseudo spins. We don't need to have the others, the tau's. And we have a somewhat simplified Lindblad form here. Okay.
This is just the local decay of the excited.
Yes. Yeah, this is the local, this is the relaxation rate of the pseudo spin independent of the system. Okay, so now how do we generate this, these Lindblad operators? So this is one proposal, and this is not unique, and I'd be very happy to talk to people here to figure out another one. I mean, it'd actually be really nice to have just a two-level system, but we're not, it's not clear that we can do that. So this is our first idea then. So we have a three-level system. So we take our cesium-133, and we take the same two levels that we're using in the system itself, same hydrophine levels, and we take a third level, so it's much higher. And the third level has one requirement, it has to have a very fast spontaneous emission. Okay? So the pseudo spin states are just like in the system qubits, they're identical, they're zeros and one. And then if we do the following sequence of pulses, do a pi pulse on one to two. So if you're in the excited state here and you want to get back, you want to flip to go back down here, as part of your cooling process, then you would do a pi pulse up to there, you wait for decay to the ground state, then you would do a phi pulse where this is this phi is determined by the population that you want to put, or you want to control in here. You do a phi pulse on 0 to 1, and then you create coherences between 0 and 1, right? So you remove those coherences by doing the same as before. You go from pi up to here, and then back down again by spontaneous emission. And if you write down the evolution of the density matrix for this sequence, in the 3x3 system will basically give you then just populations in the 2x2 system. So you've got rid of the coherences on the 2x2 system, and you've got nothing in the third state. So basically that's the thermal density matrix. So this relaxes the pseudo spin to whatever its state originally, it relaxes it to the thermal state in this subspace. So the rate of this whole process determines the parameter lambda.
How can you avoid that you don't decay back into one?
You have to, this is atomic physics, you have to choose the right levels.
But if you can excite it, then you
don't
really have to decay.
Yeah, so we have to.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea would be to choose something which has a, I don't know, we have to look at the systems. I mean, yeah.
What's your initial state?
It doesn't matter what the initial state is. Okay, if you put this sequence on, you'll eventually.
Population in zero initially.
Yeah. Yeah, you have some population in zero. Right. So there may be better ways to do this, and I'd be really happy to talk with you about other ones. But,
I guess I'm still missing kind of how would you define the objective of what you're doing?
The objective here is to basically generate the Lindblad operators for these dissipated pseudo spins. Okay, so and that means that we need to, we need to generate these operators here with this well-defined, these have to be a well-defined rate. And so that's this sequence is basically providing this rate. Okay. So now we have these thermal pseudo-spins. And then we look at what's the lowest achievable effective temperature we can get. But that's determined by the ratio of the error rate to the dissipation rate. So that's here. And so this is a point here about we have sort of for a given error per gate rate, we would put this in here and we'd have to see what we can actually achieve. This is a point I mentioned before about zero temperature versus finite temperature of interest for the toric code system. And then another side point is that if the gate noise is actually isotropic, then one wouldn't actually need these, and you don't need these at any temperature. Basically, because then you don't need to have the PO, the translation of excitations, because the whole, if the noise is isotropic, it does the translation in the excited state space for you. So,
I'm just a little bit confused by one thing. You are working on a finite charge system. Yeah. For instance, when I talk to Gerardo Ortiz, he keeps telling me that from condensed matter point of view, all they care is only thermodynamic limit.
That's fine.
Right, but
there's no such thing as an infinite optical lattice.
I agree with you.
For optical systems, you're interested in finite systems.
Is that the case?
You want to use it with controlled, well, except for fractional quantum Hall. I mean, they're basically infinite, right? I mean,
yes,
they're macroscopic.
Yeah.
For lattices, it has to be finite. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, because I always have this dilemma. Apparently, my understanding is that certain definitions have been given in thermodynamic limit.
That's fine.
And then, okay.
That's fine. But then, so you have to also look at what Castelnuovo and Chamon did, because they showed that things are quite well defined on finite systems as well. I'm not sure. It's too bad that Zohar's not here, because I'm not sure what the current state of the debate is. Finite temperature.
System, when a lattice boiling doubles, you could use a finite size system. There is a finite temperature where
things are protected, right. Yeah. So I think we're okay. And anyway, I mean, the real goal of this was, so the experimental goal, our theoretical goal is somewhat different, but the experimental goal is to demonstrate the components, to show that you can generate n-body terms and to show that you can do braiding operations. So, okay.
We have a favorable, actually, scaling that you need only a finite, if you want to increase the size of the system, you have to reduce the temperature only. The scaling is favorable, only a little bit, so it goes something like logarithmic or...
That's actually good, right. Favorable. Right. So, let me see what else. So now I just have a couple of slides from Dave about the experiment. So this is a blue detuned lattice, so that's the typical spacing that he has, so this is, I don't know, people who Cristiano and Gavin. and this is actually for Gavin. So, Gavin, this is from the horse's mouth. This configuration generates actually periodicity in the transverse direction, because those are the counterpropagating components. So you actually have this, and you have this one, and you have this one here. So you have all three. And then what he does is he just moves this one around. He just moves this pair around here so that he has another port, another direction for doing other things. So that's the way it works. So that generates, that's the configuration of the lasers that generates this cubic lattice. And this I've already shown you. This is imaging three planes that they did a few years ago with about 250 atoms. And they can call to the vibrational ground state. That's already been, they did that a number of years ago. And this is a single site addressability. This is with microwave radiation. So they would be using states that are polarization and B field insensitive. So here, so there's hyperfine states in a B field. And what they do is have this far off resonant light that changes the separation, but then they look at the field insensitive states here, and they have a sequence of pulses here. High pulses first to adjacent hyperfine levels, do the phase actually here on the field insensitive level, and then bring it back to your qubit states. Now that's the microwave gate, that's very slow, that's 30 microseconds, and that's probably the one that they'll do first. But everything that we're, our estimates are with the Raman gate, which is much faster. And this is the Rydberg entanglement.
Sorry, what was the last statement?
The Raman gates are faster.
So you prefer to do Raman?
I do, because if you're asking, if you've got to generate 20, if you've got to do 20 of these gates, then you want to have it faster, right, rather than slower.
And they can do it experimentally as well.
Yeah, but they're not yet. They do the other one first for experimental reasons. Yeah, and the Raman gate has the other advantage that there's very little leakage if you have these Raman pulses coming in collinear. You can avoid polarization errors, which would have been a major source of.
But if you do the Raman gate, the splitting because of the B field is large enough to distinguish between the different sites still.
Well, if you do the Raman gate, you don't need the B field.
Exactly. So how do you have the single-site addressability? Or it's just because of the
huge
spacing?
I think it's the large spacing.
Yeah.
It's the large spacing. Yeah. Okay. So this is the phase gate. The Rydberg gate that they would use. Basically, you have. So this is the qubit levels here and here, and this is the control and the target, and if you put the control qubit up in the Rydberg state, then, and you do a 2-pi pulse on the target, then if this guy is up here in the control, then there'll be a phase shift when you come down again and you excite this one off resonant, whereas if this is not there, there will be no phase shift. That generates your C-phase gate. And that's also about 100 nanoseconds. So the problems here that one wants to protect against are spontaneous emission from this level, which is hard, I understand. So I guess do it as fast as possible. So doing it as fast as possible then might mean that one would have to do an arbitrary phase gate. In other words, do a smaller phase. And that's possible if somewhat more complicated. This is a proposal from Zoller's group of using EIT to do that. Okay, so that's with Weiss's addressability, he has about 26 near neighbors, but he can actually pick out, isolate pairs without affecting the other pairs. So that's pretty good right now. So he has very well focused beams. And this is another scheme. These are just some other ways that one might implement the toroidal geometry of the 2D lattice in a 3D system. So you could, for instance, wrap this around like this and have swaps going up here, or you could have much more complicated things like this. And this is probably a good thing to optimize in terms of counting the number of swap gates, but we haven't done that yet. Okay, so that's basically, this is detail. That's everything.
Since you have all these additional levels, it's easier. Maybe you could dump one of the spins into some non-interacting levels and then get a punctured plane.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that was one of the original sort of benefits of atoms and optical lattices. Yeah, that would create. Yeah, you remove something from the Hilbert space and then you've got the puncture.
Yeah.
And then you braid or you go around there. Yeah.
I would think that the swapping, the periodic, constructed periodic thing is intuitively appealing, but probably it's not necessary if you have the whole thing. same.
Oh, then you don't need the toroidal boundary condition.
So you get a twofold degeneracy per hole.
Okay.
So it's like you have qubits and.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea. Yeah, we'll look at that. Yeah, yeah, that would actually be very useful. Yeah, because you save a lot on these swap operations to go around on the outside.
Only one plane.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that. Okay, so because we're working quite closely with the experimentalists, so they have three 5x5, 5x5 system that's really perfect. So we really only have in a plane a 5x5. So that's not really a lot. We might still have to do some kind of. So we need these extra spins for the thermalization as well around the sides, or sort of like one plane probably would have to be taken up with the thermalization spins. Maybe two, if we're having two sets, one above and one below, and that would leave you with 5x5 in the middle. Yeah, we'd have to. We have to. Yeah. 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 No. I mean, we have to look at what one can do, but that's a. It's a good point in general to avoid the periodic boundary conditions because they'd be expensive.
In terms of trying to design or tailor a limplet operator.
Yeah.
It could be an interesting variation on what we Ronnie and Jose Paulo developed a method for designing unitary gates.
Right.
Using optimal control. Until you have essentially a non-unitary operator.
Right.
That you're trying to make.
Yes.
And you have some controls.
Right.
Presumably just formulated as an optimal control problem. You know, where you have a control field and you have and you have a target, which is a dissipative, which is a non-Hermitian operator.
Yeah, but you have to link it to some place. Just at the end, you have to generate entropy, so you have to have them.
Yeah, but the target here was just to make a certain non-Hermitian operator.
This part can be optimized.
Yeah, you have to throw away the entropy. The entropy here goes into radiation eventually.
No, but there's dissipation in the evolution.
Yeah.
So you have this. You have a Hamiltonian and a dissipative part of the evolution.
Right.
But your target is some kind of non-Hermitian operator.
Yeah, you could.
So it'd be interesting.
Yeah. I mean the.
I was asking about
It'll be an interesting variation. It's a little bit different from I think anything that.
Well, one thing you could start with is just to optimize this. This rate here, which is one optimize different components of the spinblad. But you're asking about optimizing the entire thing, right?
We can create an entropy preserving non-unitary operator. I can do that.
But this dissipation, is spontaneous emission in the evolution.
Yeah, you need that. You have to have that. Because let's say unitary operator preserves also all the eigenvalues. So let's say I want to do something that's entropy preserving.
Yeah.
But non-unitary. And I have an example like that we could do that with dissipation.
And you can do it optimally.
We can try that. But probably yes.
I mean, this.
You can do this too, it's not optimal.
That
you probably could do optimal.
Yeah. But then that's entropy preserving, right?
Hmm?
It's entropy preserving.
Hey, you don't have to have
entropy. Oh, okay.
It just.
Yeah. Oh, we could. Yeah, that would. That's interesting.
You might be able to
think about it.
Try to make. You have a few lint blood guys that you want to do at the same time, right?
Yeah.
So that would be interesting to kind of. Try to make the whole set the same control sequence.
Yeah, okay.
The general system which you show, so you want to create a mixed state on the state which doesn't have the coherence, right?
If you were to go,
You want to kill the non-diagonal elemental density matrix from the transition 0-1, which doesn't have decay or decoherence at all. So I'm just wondering how you can do that. So you don't want to have coherence term 0-1, right?
No, but you want to have specific population ratio.
Yeah, that means.
So you generate that population ratio. Yeah, that's what we're doing, yeah.
You don't have
decoherence. That's right. But we're continually regenerating that state.
So how the coherence dies between 0 and 1?
It's exponential, I mean, usually, right? Oh, it decays by spontaneous emission here.
Yeah, but from 2 to 0, not
yeah, but,
zero.
But that's the whole point of having the three-level system, that you're driving, you're driving it up through there and then looking at the decay here. That this decay drives the decay of these off-diagonal elements.
But in principle, the optical pattern can do this, right?
I hope, yeah, maybe. I mean, I'd like to talk to, I don't know that much about it, but I'd like
to
talk to someone.
If you consider decay back to the ground in the state 1, and then you do the pressure.
Well, so another thing is to bear in mind is we'd like to actually be able to do this globally. So there's no reason to single out individual spins. And if you do it globally, maybe one can get away with having a single, just a two-level system. But I don't know, I'd have to. Yeah, we should talk because this was just the first thing we came up with, and I'm not too familiar with optical pumping, so I'd be happy to talk also and see if there's more options.